All right, I'm joined right now by Rand Fishkin. Rand is the founder of Moz and his new project, Sparkturo. We're going to talk about that and what it means for great digital marketers. But I want to spend a few moments while I've got Rand and talk about where many of us discovered him and his talent, which is Whiteboard Friday. Rand, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Todd.
You know, super cool. I'm a fan of Whiteboard Friday. I think Whiteboard Friday did a lot of groundbreaking things for digital marketing. And I think it really launched you into the minds of a lot of marketers. Talk to me about what inspired you to get started with Whiteboard Friday.
This was many years ago at Moz 2007. And we happened to have a camera. And I was explaining something about SEO, I think about how redirects work, to one of my colleagues there. And he said, hang on, I'm going to grab our new camera and I'll film you explaining this to me and we'll try and put it on the blog. All right, sure. It did not go particularly well. Right. So the first year, 2 years of Whiteboard Fridays were low quality in terms of the video themselves. Of course, I was not very experienced and didn't have a great sense of the audience, but we kept with it because we knew we were improving. And because we felt like there was opportunity there, that if we could build up this muscle in video marketing, that we would eventually reap some rewards. And that turned out to be true. You know, 3, maybe 4 years into it, Whiteboard Friday started performing almost as well as our normal blog content. And then I think it was probably around 2014. That it started to be consistently every week, it was the top performing piece of content that we put out. So by serializing something, by creating something that was, you know, not episodic, but felt like a connected experience and a consistent one, you know, we were finding that many agencies and companies would gather their marketing teams, they sit around and have lunch on Friday, and they all watch Whiteboard Friday together, and then they talk about whatever the topic was. And it became this collective experience in the field and also turned into a great bit of content for Moz.
You know, Rand, it's super interesting for me because I've been a digital marketer since the beginning, like when you got started, and now we're in our 20-ish in years in digital, and watching this grow up, I remember in 2007 seeing Whiteboard Friday, thinking there's something really revolutionary here. And then I started to notice that when people were approaching me to create their videos, they were asking me to create whiteboard videos, which I always attributed back to you and the paradigm of people seeing how valuable just a simple whiteboard could be to education.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of nice because a talking head in front of a camera has, you know, certain qualities, and some people are extraordinary at doing just that. But the whiteboard adds an element that I think you can take away, right? You can take a photo of that whiteboard and you can use that content in other ways. You're forced as an educator, right, as someone who's teaching, to be able to draw up your concept logically and intelligently. I think that forcing function actually makes the content of the video better. We've had a lot of guests come in and do Whiteboard Friday over the years, probably 60 or 70 people who come in from outside of Moz. You know, they come to Whiteboard Friday Studios for the first time, and we walk them through the process. And just the process of drawing up their thoughts, drawing up what they want to present, makes them a more qualified and high quality presenter of that information. And so I think that it does provide a little bit of special magic, just like preparing slides, even if the slides are, you know, purely photographs and visuals. It gives structure to the format, and I think can make people who might have challenges speaking extemporaneously a little bit better.
Okay, I buy all of that. In fact, what I've really seen over the years is marketers have taken their concepts off of their heads, you know, this big like mad scientist cooking, and turned it into something that their team in the office could visually see and their clients could visually see. And a lot of that goes back to the laying out of how these pieces are interconnected and the concept pieces come together. And, you know, without bragging too much about you, I think that's one of the first places I saw digital marketing strategy laid out visually for people. Ran, for video creators out there that are just getting started, oh, one of the things that's super cool about Rand is you've always been very transparent about what you're going through and your career, and that's allowed people like me to feel like we know, like, and trust you on a more intimate level. When you got started with Whiteboard Friday, it wasn't an immediate hit. It took a little while. It needed to gain steam and then followers. Why did you pick Friday? How important was consistency of a schedule? And then the other part was, when did it start to really let you know that this was a big deal and people were following you?
Yeah, sure. So first off, I just want to be clear that, like many things at Moz, because this was my first company, I had very little experience. A lot of the early efforts were purely accidental. So it was on a Friday because that's when we published it. It just was convenient. It was also on a Friday because that was when I was really tired of blogging every night.
Right.
And so we were like, okay, you know, we'll give Rand a little break on Thursday night. He won't have to blog. We'll just put up the Whiteboard Friday video. Because I blogged Sunday through Thursday night for the first, you know, 5 years.
Massive burnout, I'm sure. Roller coaster.
Right. Just so that that was one of the big reasons why, oh my God, you know, I take 30 minutes and film a video. Oh, it's heaven. So much easier.
Right.
And then I think, so we started getting better about measuring the blog's impact on the business as opposed to just raw traffic, probably not until 2012, 2013. Mm-hmm. But even before that, we could see that the, you know, number of visits that Whiteboard Friday drove compared to a blog post, the pages per visit, the browse rate, the bounce rate, right, time on site, all these metrics, was worse for Whiteboard Friday for its first 2-3 years. And then a few years in, it started performing almost as well as an average blog post. And then, like I said, about 7 years in, it started being, you know, the top performing content every week.
And at along the way, I'm sure when you would go to conferences, people would come up to you and they would, kind of like Eric Enge and Mark Traphagen are experiencing now, where people are involved, they're part of the culture, they get the jokes and the humor. And when they see you, you're the guru that's been guiding them. At some point you started seeing that, right? And that was an indicator of success.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that I had, I had small bits of that even before Whiteboard Friday, thanks to just speaking at lots of conferences and events and blogging. But Whiteboard Friday certainly made that more visible. I think made me more visible and made my face more memorable.
Right.
People were like, oh yeah, I watch you a lot. I know who you are. It also probably led to a lot more invitations to keynote conferences and events, which then, you know, I sort of had the forcing function of upgrading the quality of what I was doing and presenting for these large audiences and big conferences and events. And that led to good things as well.
All right, when you're filming a Whiteboard Friday video, how many takes until you've rolled through it? Like, how many times you have to do it before Rand is being Rand on that final video?
Just one.
Really?
I think we've only ever had two times where we had to film more than once. And one of those was my mistake entirely. And the other one was a technical issue.
Wow.
So
that's pretty awesome. That's some street cred right there, dude.
Well, I think it also speaks to the fact that we are very willing to make Whiteboard Friday informal.
Right.
Right. It does not have to be flawless and scripted. If you watch it, I have us and ums and mistakes and, oh, wait a minute, hang on, let me erase that. This right. is what I meant. You know, those kinds of things.
Right.
And that works out fine. I think it makes the video process vastly easier, the production process. And it also means that I think the audience sees a more real, transparent version of me, which I like. I don't pretend to be this flawless, perfect, you know, being. And so that's what I like.
To your credit, though, because that allows people who don't really physically know you to know you quicker because you've been vulnerable over the years.
Yeah. I mean, so I think that vulnerability is a key component of true transparency, mm-hmm. right? If you are honest about those things that you're proud of that make you look good, that is not real transparency. If you're honest about things that make you look bad about your mistakes, about things that really keep you up at night, about things that you fear people think about you, then that's vulnerability, and that contributes to real transparency.
Yep. Well, listen,
I'm much more a believer in transparency than in honesty.
You know, Rand, it's really interesting. As an entrepreneur, I have for the last 8 years, our company's been growing tremendously, but I went through the perfect storm in Q4. And I've been in Q4 of 2017. And I came out on the right end of it, but it was the scariest experience. And I know as an entrepreneur, you've been through it too over the times, probably far too many times. And I'm close to telling this story and I'm almost done with all my personal therapy work and have figured out how beneficial it is for people to hear the lessons learned along the way. Because when I went through it, the greatest discovery, and I'll share it another time, was that the answers to my business, just like the answers to my clients' digital marketing campaigns, are always inside the analytics. Except the analytics weren't what I was nerding out on, which is like traffic to the site and bounce rate and conversion rates and all of these things, watch time. The analytics were in business metrics that I was less interested in looking at, you know, like profit margin and how fast it took for clients to pay and how do I optimize those things. And once I did it, it was like opening up the holy grail for improving the company. And I'll get to all that at another time. But you do inspire me for how vulnerable you've been. And I know that to my followers, this will also be equally as valuable. They watched me go through it and couldn't figure out what in the world was going on inside my dome. So, yeah. Right? And I've been following your blog. Can we talk about SparkTuro? Then we'll talk about the blog. But talk to me about SparkTuro and what this service is going to bring for people in the digital marketing world.
Yeah, sure. So SparkToro is right now just a blog with a couple of little side projects on it. So one of those is this trending service that it's free. You just connect your Twitter account and then it shows you sort of here's all the news that web marketers are talking about on a given day. So if you're one of those people who goes to Twitter and scrolls through your feed trying to figure out, okay, what's the hot news? Like, what are the big topics today? What are we all sharing? You can go to SparkToro Trending and get that sort of much more quickly.
That's cool.
The eventual actual product is probably still at least 6, probably more like 9 months away. And that, what it's designed to do is to help marketers solve a particular pain point that I saw a lot while I was at Moz, which is, you know, if you're not getting a ton of search volume for the terms and phrases that can bring you good customers, you instead have to amplify your message to your audience, get in front of your audience in other ways, right? Search isn't going to do it for you because there's just not that inbound demand.
Right.
And for those folks, what I saw was, you know, over and over and over again, right? Okay, marketer, your job is go figure out all the places besides just Google Ads and Facebook Ads that we should be participating in that we can use to get in front of our audience. And the marketer would go, okay. And they'd take, you know, they'd go to Google and they'd search for, you know, top, you know, our subject blogs, top news sites in our subject, top podcasts in our subject, top events in our subject, and make a big, you know, spreadsheet of all these different, you know, media and offline and online opportunities and social networks and individual influencers, as well as brands and websites and media. And then they'd try and add in a bunch of metrics, right? Sometimes maybe something like from Moz, like DA, or they'd go to SimilarWeb and get, you know, the top sites in a particular category, and they'd try and estimate traffic. And maybe they'd go to BuzzSumo and look for content that had performed well in that field and what websites it was on and who wrote it. And then they'd add contact information. You build up this giant Excel spreadsheet over the course of a month, maybe two, and then you come back and say, okay, I've got the list. Now we'll create the marketing plan and figure out, you know, which of these sites we're going to do advertising on versus, you know, what are we trying to do, organic placement or whatever it is to get in front of this audience and broadcast our message, amplify our message. And that, it felt ridiculous to me. Like, Todd, it felt to me the way SEO felt in 2002.
Right.
When you had to do manual rank tracking and manual site visits and manual view source on every HTML page. It, ridiculous. And I had this frustration. I thought, you know what? Software should solve this. We can build a giant database, right? I'm good at sort of big data design, product design. I've done that before, of all these profiles, and then we can query against this database and show you, you know, here are the podcasts that interior decorators actually listen to. Here are the events that they go to. Here are the publications they read. Here's who they follow on LinkedIn or Twitter or Instagram or whatever it is. And that's what I want to be able to deliver directly without forcing this multi-week, multi-month process.
You're basically shortening the learning curve and then having the data so now they can be going from point A to point Z at a more accelerated rate with better intel.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, part of it is we want to save you a bunch of time. The other part is we want to make this way more accurate, right? So this process that you have to do, or that you really should be doing if you're not, is biased by what ranks, you know, in Google, right? Rather than what people are actually paying attention to, which often those two things are different. It's also biased by, you know, vanity metrics like follower count as opposed to true engagement. And from what we've seen, those two are very disconnected. There are a lot of accounts on all sorts of social platforms that have tons of followers and get very little engagement. No one's paying attention to them versus many smaller accounts that get a tremendous amount of engagement but don't have as many followers per se, and they get ignored. And so we're trying to fix that problem as well. And then I think there's just tons of people who don't do this process at all because it's too difficult,
right?
Because it's too weird and confusing. I sent a tweet out about it yesterday. I was sort of like, okay, I've interviewed, you know, dozens of people about this process, maybe 100 now. And here's what they all tell me. Are these 11 steps really what everyone does? And, you know, the tweet did extremely well. Lots of people replied and were like, yep, that's pretty much how my day goes every day.
Well, I think there's a lot of people, and marketing has, when we got started, man, it was like, you could be a marketer that also built websites, that understood content and search. And then the big bang happened and we all had to figure out what piece of the galaxy was ours. That right? And I think I'm lucky, and from following you over the years, I see a similar trend with you, that we got started so early that we got a foundation taught by the early pioneers, that foundation is still in many ways very relevant today. Of course, there's new sediment on top. But now we are in this period where the specialists are really that guru of that space. And it's fun to watch as your career goes on that you continue to refine and develop a process. This is going to be a really healthy transition for you to spread your wings once again. And I'm excited to see what you're doing at SparkTuro. Let's talk about your book, man. I mean, I see it in the background right there. And one of the cool things, right, Lost and Founder. And as a founder, how many times do I feel lost? Talk to me about what inspired you, besides being lost, along the way to tell the story.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's experiences like these, right, where you and I will share a conversation and we'll talk about, you know, depression and anxiety, and we'll talk about the ups and downs of building a company and of professional life. And we'll talk about, you know, hiring and firing people and management. We might talk about marketing, you know, especially in the broad sense of like, gosh, this growth hacking movement is really biasing a lot of people in the wrong way. And growth hacks only have this one use and purpose. And all those kinds of conversations that I found myself having again and again with, usually with other founders and entrepreneurs, but often with, you know, folks who are part of smaller teams or part of growing businesses, I wanted to scale that. You know, I wanted to be able to have that beer or that coffee with thousands or tens of thousands of people instead of just dozens or hundreds of people. And the book, I think, is the way to do that. Mm-hmm. So it's very different from a traditional business book. You know, a classic business book is have one concept that's easily explainable in a few sentences, and then make, you know, 15 chapters that expand upon it and add examples and data and research. And that's not this book, right? Mm-hmm. Lost and Founder cannot be summarized in a paragraph or three or 10. you know, it is a series of chapters, each of which tells a number of stories and fights against a particular bias or misconception or myth that kind of classic Silicon Valley startup wisdom has taught us over the years. My hope is, look, a lot of founders, you're going to go out there, you're going to make mistakes, just like I did, just like you did, Todd, right? But you don't have to make exactly the same mistakes that I did.
Right.
And that's what I hope people can get from this.
I'm looking forward to reading it. And it's, I know for me, going to be therapeutic to listen to somebody else go through it, right? But what I've also discovered is that as a digital marketer that obsesses on optimizing every little piece of a project or a client campaign, as soon as I took that same passion and applied it for my business and how what the business's processes are, which is really an area that I really was totally disinterested in, and most founders are, right? Because we're like the big concepts. But once I started to lay that out for my own company and started looking at the real dollars invested in each space, it became a whole lot easier to be successful and to scale a company. And the phase that we're going through right now is the scaling phase, because we just figured out what the real costs of everything were. And I know as entrepreneurs learn about their business, often the beginning is, well, let's just charge a lot and then we'll always be on the good end. But I learned so much more by going through a crappy quarter, and that ended up turning into a major blessing. And I think there's a lot of lessons learned that I'm sure I can glean from what you've gone through along the way. So thank you for doing that. Rand, you're an inbound guy. Can we nerd out on inbound for a moment and just talk about the value of inbound for the right businesses? Like, what are some companies or businesses that you think benefit from inbound as opposed to other models like account-based marketing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, so, well, first off, it's interesting because inbound means different things to different people. And so we have to be careful about classifying. So for me, inbound has always meant earning your visitors and your audience rather than buying them.
Okay.
And I think that model works extraordinarily well when you have any type of product that is self-service. So e-commerce works great for self-service SaaS. It works really well for, I think it works quite well for a lot of B2B services that are sort of a mixed model where you can, freemium up front, and then you have account managers after you sign up. And I would say it's not a great match when it is, so I know a lot of consultancies, for example, who are more successful doing networking and networking style sales than they are doing purely, doing a lot of content marketing and SEO and social media and all of these forms of creation, content creation and amplification. So yeah, I think it has its uses, and if you have passion around it, that's a big thing that can certainly give you a lot of energy there and value. But I don't recommend it for everyone. For some people, ads are just great. Sales can be fine. Pure networking works well.
And maybe the key here is testing, right? Like, as the more experienced I get in digital marketing, the more I'm willing to recognize that I need to question every assumption, especially my own, and that experience and wisdom can also get in the way of finding opportunities. Your career is an example of early birds getting the worm, and my success has been also. And so I like to get places early, but you have to be willing to test, and you have to be willing to fail and run multiple tests to see where it's going to bear fruit. And I'm particularly an inbound fan because I'm a teacher at my core. I know that about you too. You like to share what you're learning along the way.
Yeah.
And you can do that with inbound in a very way and never really feel like you're selling. Do you have a similar experience with that?
Yeah. I mean, this is why I rejected sales, for all the years that I was at Moz, is because I hate selling. I don't like the process. I don't like the kind of awkwardness that comes with it in human relationships. And I think it forces you not to be authentic.
Mm-hmm.
Like it just, inherently does. You cannot, you can do sales in a very authentic manner, but it will never be as authentic as a non-financially constrained relationship. Just can't be.
Yep.
And I think that I also know that it's not, because I have such a visceral reaction against it, I know that I'm not going to build up a great muscle there. And I don't tend to work well with people who do build up great muscles there, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it is optimal that that I would be in a different kind of environment and situation. But that's, I think this is the process that I recommend, right? That this self-knowledge and self-discovery and understanding what you do well and what you get along with and why you believe the things that you do and what you actually believe, I think that's more important than, oh, Rand thinks this, maybe I should think this too. No. That's the wrong lesson to take, I think, from any conversation about, you know, values or direction or strategic positioning. This is a discovery process that we all do for ourselves.
Absolutely. My first inbound campaign was during my HubSpot 30-day free trial. And I knew I was going to a conference. I was going to be speaking there. I looked at the exhibitor list and figured these are the companies that I want to schedule meetings with their marketing team before I even roll in, right? And so I started a email drip sequence campaign with videos. And I started tracking on the back end who was crushing my videos, right? And then did a follow-up, scheduled a meeting with the people that were showing the highest level of attention span. And what I discovered when I showed up, I had educated them. And they were asking me questions that were normally going to happen right before they buy. So maybe like 8 weeks later. In a sales cycle, they were asking is like question two or question three. And what I discovered is I collapsed the sales cycle, and this is going back, you know, right at the early days of HubSpot. And so what's funny about it is in my 30-day free trial had generated $350,000 in new revenue. And all I was doing was teaching people what they needed to learn and using video. So I only had to teach it once. And that's a really cool trick once you could realize how powerful and persuasive the education can be, because as we're seeing, 82% of buyers now want to go on their own education journey before they're ready to make a buying decision and interact with a salesperson. So that works really well in a SaaS product. And I'm sure you guys are going to be doing something similar when you start to lay out your service.
I suspect so.
Cool. Well, Rand Fishkin, thank you so much for joining us. For those of you that would like to get Rand's book, the book's title is Lost and Founder. You can go to sparkturo.com, and I'll make sure that's on the show notes page for this episode, wirebuzz.com/162, or just go to sparkturo.com. I'll spell that sparkturo.com. Rand Fishkin, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.